So we're starting our Christmas sermon series today. We finished our Everyday Grace series, which we've had so far up until this point. And over the next few weeks, we're going to have a bit of a Christmas theme as we get ready for the big day. As we kind of look forward to Christmas Day happening, we're going to have a few sermons on the Christmas theme. Now this morning, I wonder how you feel about Christmas. Are you one of these people like this lady here? Are you one of these people that just loves Christmas? You love all the lights and all the everything that's going on. You can't wait. One of my work colleagues back in June emailed around a website with a countdown of how many days there were until Christmas. He's one of these guys that loves Christmas. Another one of my colleagues loves singing Christmas carols all through the year. So some people love Christmas, like this lady here. But maybe you're a bit like me. Maybe you're a bit of a grumpy pants. And I can admit it, I'm a bit of a grumpy pants, just ask my family. And I'm not all that keen about Christmas. I know it's a bit of a confession, and don't judge me for it. But when it comes to Christmas, I'm like, oh, Christmas carols again. I mean, the carol service is going to be great later. I mean, I love those carols in the Christmas service, but just not on the radio all the time. And when you walk into shops and you have those Christmas adverts and you're just like, oh, bit of a Christmas grump I am. But I guess we're all different, aren't we? Some of us love Christmas. Some of us, like me, don't love Christmas so much. But I guess for however we feel about Christmas, actually Christmas becomes a really busy time for us, isn't it? There's lots going on at Christmas. There's lots of things to get ready. There's lots of presents to buy. If you're visiting people, there's arrangements to be made. And suddenly Christmas can feel like a really busy time of year, can't it? I know at work, my work is the busiest at Christmas. That's probably why I'm a bit more grumpy at Christmas, because it is just so hectic at work. There's so much to get done before the new year. There's less days that we're in. Everyone wants everything done before Christmas. And it is just a real rush, real hectic time. But this morning, I just want to say to you, just spend some time this morning, really just kind of putting all those thoughts aside. If you're super excited about Christmas and you've got lots of plans to make, and just put it aside just for a minute. If you're super grumpy like me, just kind of put your grumpiness aside just for a few minutes this morning and really focus on the real meaning of Christmas. Just really focus on what we've got to look at this morning as we look at Jesus. Now, I really love cheesy stuff. You're learning a lot about me this morning. I'm quite grumpy, but I also like really cheesy stuff. So I like cheesy songs, kind of 70s disco music, and I love really cheesy sayings, especially, you know, those like church billboards you see on the internet that are based in America, and they've got these really cheesy slogans. And one of the slogans I really like is this one: Jesus is the reason for the season. I reckon we should have this plastered on everything we're doing, on all the Christmas stuff. Maybe it's too late this year. Maybe we can do it next year. Kind of get it all over the flyers and stuff that we're going to send out. It is a cheesy saying, but actually, it's really deep and profound. Because Jesus is the reason for the season, isn't he? It's Christmas, Christmas, Jesus Christ. Jesus really is the reason for the season. So yes, it is cheesy, but we really do need to focus on Jesus, the reason for the season. And we're going to do that by looking at a book called John. We're going to spend some time today looking at John, and then in 2 weeks' time, James is going to do a bit more on this book of John. And this morning, we're looking at chapter 1, verses 1 to 13. And there's no guesses for guessing who wrote the book of John. It was a guy called John. And he was an eyewitness to Jesus. He was one of Jesus' closest followers. So he was one of his disciples who became an apostle. And he spent his time traveling around with Jesus, hearing the things that Jesus taught, seeing the miracles that Jesus did. He had private discussions with Jesus. He was the disciple that described himself as a disciple that Jesus loved. So he had this close relationship with Jesus. And what he's done is he's written it all down. He's written down an account of everything that he saw Jesus do, and all the things that he heard Jesus teach. And he's written it down into this eyewitness account, this book of John. And one of the things that I love about John is he doesn't kind of try and bring in cryptic messages about trying to tell us what he's trying to explain what he's telling us. He tells us straight. He tells us exactly why he's written this book. And I like that, because I don't always pick up on the kind of nuanced stuff. I need to be told stuff straight. And John's really good at this. He says this in chapter 20, so near the end of John. This is why he's written this account of Jesus. This is why he's written this book about Jesus. It says, these things are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So John is 100% convinced that by believing in Jesus, that we can have life. By believing in Jesus, we can have life. So to John, Jesus is a matter of life and death. To John, Jesus is the most important person that has ever lived on this earth. And so John wants to tell us about Jesus. That's why he's written this account of Jesus. He wants to tell us about him, because it is a matter of life and death. And so that's what we're going to be looking at this morning. We're going to be looking at new life in Jesus. Now, for those of you who have been a Christian for many years, you might be thinking to yourselves, I know all this already. I know this stuff. This isn't new to me. I've known this stuff. I've done it in Sunday school when I was a kid. I've done it in youth group. I've done it all my life. I know all of this stuff. Well, if that's you, then I want to say, please stay focused. Don't kind of drift off thinking, oh, I know all this. It's going to be the same old sermon I've heard again. Please stay focused. Please kind of stay focused on Jesus, because I really believe that God wants to speak to you this morning and remind you just how amazing and wonderful Jesus is. And it will help you stay strong in your faith. If you really understand deeply why you believe what you believe, and if you understand who Jesus is and why he's so important, it will help you stay strong in your faith. It will help you stop kind of drifting off away from Jesus. It will help you stay focused and rooted on Jesus. And it will help you to help others grow as well. And it will help you to help others come to faith. If you can really understand who Jesus is and why he's important in your life. So here in chapter 1, we're given a massive reason why we should believe in Jesus. John kind of starts off with a real whopper, a massive reason why we should believe in Jesus. And he tells us that very, very clearly in the first few lines, which leads us into my first point, which is Jesus has the power to give new life because he is God. And as I said, John just kind of gets straight into it. I love this about John. He just kind of jumps straight in. The first few verses, he explains exactly who Jesus is. This is what he says. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. So here he is. Straight away, he's declaring that Jesus is God. Jesus is God. And he uses that weird phrase, the Word. So he uses it three times there, the Word. And he's using that to describe Jesus, to say this is Jesus. So when he says the Word, he means Jesus. But it's a bit of a weird word, isn't it? What does the word mean? What is he trying to say by using the Word? Well, it's actually a word that the people back in the time that John was writing this, they would have been familiar with this. This is a word that they would have used. To us, 2,000 years later, it's a word we don't use. So we're a bit kind of, oh, what's John trying to do there? So it's worth us just kind of spending a minute just thinking, what does the word mean? And what is John trying to say through using this word? Now, you'll have to bear with me because I'm not an expert on Greek philosophy. But I've read a few books about this passage and I've read a few kind of Bible commentaries. And they describe the word as a Greek word. It's actually logos, which is a Greek word. And they describe the word logos to mean a force, a sort of an impersonal force that was creating the world. So the world was created through this impersonal force called the Logos. So it's this kind of impersonal force that creates everything around us, creates the world and sustains creation. Don't ask me any more about that because I'm not sure I fully understand it, but just get this idea. It's this creative force that created the world. So the question is then, why is John calling Jesus the Logos? Why is John calling Jesus the Word? Well, by calling Jesus the Logos, by calling Jesus the Word, John is saying that it's Jesus that created the world. It's Jesus that created the world. And he further stresses that point in the next verse, which is, through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. So Jesus has created the world, and John is at pains to stress this point, that Jesus is the creative force that created this world, that he is God, that he created this world. But why is this so important? Why is it so important that Jesus is God? Why is it so important that Jesus created the world. Well, John goes on to expand a little bit in the next couple of verses, in verses 4 and 5, where he says, in him was life, and that life was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, but the darkness has not overcome it. See, John describes that in Jesus is life. In Jesus is life. And then he describes that life as light. And John loves this analogy of light. He uses it in, he's written some other letters, he uses it in there, and he uses it all through this account of Jesus. And I think to really understand what he's getting at when he talks about light here, is we need to turn our Bibles all the way back to the beginning, back to the book of Genesis, right back to the first chapter of Genesis, chapter 1. I've got a couple of verses there, verses 2 and 3, where it says, now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and God said, let there be light, and then there was light. So what John is doing here when he describes Jesus as light is he's making this connection all the way back to Genesis, all the way back to the very first book of the Bible, where it describes how God created the world. There was just darkness and emptiness. There was nothing there, and God created light out of that emptiness, out of that darkness, out of nothing. God created light. And he goes on to create life. So that's what John is doing. He's making this connection between Jesus being the light and back to Genesis, creation of light, of God creating light, of God creating light out of darkness. And what he's saying is that Jesus, who is the light, the new life that Jesus gives us, the new light that Jesus gives us, is the same creation miracle that happened when God created the world. So when someone becomes a Christian, it's the same miracle that happened when God created the world, right back at the beginning in the book of Genesis. So if you're a Christian, you're a new creation. You're a miracle. You're a new creation. God has taken you from complete and utter darkness and emptiness and nothingness into complete and glorious light. And Jesus has the power to do that amazing work in us. Because only God can do that work. Only God can create the world. If we went around the room now and we kind of said to each other, why don't you just create your own world? Why don't you just kind of say a few words and create your own world? I don't think any of us could do it. In fact, I'm pretty convinced none of us could do it. Only God can do that amazing creation work. And because Jesus is God, he can do that work. Because Jesus is God, he can do that creation work in each one of us. So that's why John is so keen to say, look, Jesus is God. Jesus has created the world. He wants us to know that. So John opens his account with this kind of really amazing statement about Jesus being God, about Jesus creating the world. But then all of a sudden he starts talking about another guy called John. This gets a bit confusing. So we've got John here talking about another guy called John in the book of John. And for someone like me who's dyslexic, this is a bit of a nightmare. But the question is why? Why all of a sudden is John describing Jesus in this amazing way? And then he starts talking about someone called John, who I'm going to call John the Baptist, just because it is John the Baptist, even though John doesn't say that. It just stops me getting confused with my Johns. So we've got John, who wrote the book, and John the Baptist, who's the other John that he's written about. All clear? Okay. So that leads me on to this, my second point, which is Jesus has authority to give new life because he is the promised king. See, through the story of the Old Testament, there is a promise of a king. One day God is going to send a Messiah or a Christ. They're the same word, and they refer to this promised king that God is going to send. And it's a promise that's made numerous times throughout the Old Testament. God's people were waiting and looking for this king to arrive. And he would establish this perfect and amazing kingdom that would last for all eternity. All of God's enemies would be defeated. It would be an eternal kingdom where there'd be no suffering, pain. It would be perfect. God's people under God's perfect king for all of eternity. And we learned from other books of the Bible that it was John the Baptist's job to prepare the way for this Messiah, to prepare the way for this coming king. And his job was to tell everyone that the king is coming, the king is on his way. And then when the king arrived, it was his job to say, this is the king, this is the Messiah, this is the Christ, this is the one that we've all been waiting for. So we see what John has to say about John in verses 6 to 9, where he says, there was a man sent from God whose name was John. He came as a witness to testify concerning the light, so that through him all might believe. He himself was not the light. He came only as a witness to the light. The true light that gives light to everyone was coming into the world. So he was sent by God to testify, to witness concerning the light. And that's why John's including this section in his opening account of who Jesus is. He wants to say to us that the Messiah, the Christ is here. The person that they've been waiting for in the whole of the Old Testament is here. He's here. The Christ is here. The King is here. This is the person that the whole of the Old Testament has been pointing to. He's here. See, John is wanting to make it clear right from the beginning of his account that we need to take notice of Jesus. We need to look at Jesus. Jesus is the light that gives light to every man. It's all about Jesus. Look at Jesus. Now, I don't know if you like darts. It's not something I'm particularly keen on. I like playing it, you know, kind of lobbing a dartboard can be quite fun. But watching it on telly, it's not something I particularly enjoy. I find it quite boring. I'm sorry if there's any darts fans here that enjoy it. But I remember a few years ago, it was a good few years ago before we had kids, because I had time to sit down and watch telly. Marie was off at work and I probably had a whole Saturday afternoon to myself. Brilliant. For an introvert, that is a dream. So anyway, I was kind of flicking through the TV channels, desperately trying to find something to watch. I couldn't find anything. I had all this time by myself to watch telly and I couldn't find anything to watch. And I ended up flicking onto a darts match. And as I say, I'm not overly keen on darts. But I don't know if this happens at every darts match. There was this guy with a microphone. He was giving this amazing introduction, this amazing kind of whipping the crowd up into a frenzy. It was amazing what he was saying. And the crowd were getting excited, and he was describing how this was going to be the best sporting spectacle ever. This was going to be the best thing to watch. If you miss this, you're going to miss out. And I was like, yes, Marie's at work. I've got control of the remote. I'm going to watch this amazing sporting competition. That's going to be the best thing ever. And then the darts players walked in, and they looked very unhealthy, and maybe they could do with a wash. And then they started throwing darts at a dartboard, and I realised actually darts is really boring. It really isn't very interesting at all. But Jesus, how much better is Jesus than darts? Bear with me. How much better is Jesus than darts? So when they introduced this darts match, I was disappointed. But when John introduces Jesus, he doesn't even get close to how brilliant and amazing and wonderful and awesome and all these other describing words that Jesus is. Jesus is brilliant. He's amazing. And John is trying to say to us, look at Jesus. Look at him. Look at him. He is amazing. Fix your eyes on Jesus. Fix your eyes on Jesus. He is God himself. He created the world. He's the promised king that's going to rule for all eternity, a perfect kingdom. Fix your eyes on Jesus. Look at Jesus. He's opening his book, his account of Jesus. And he wants to say to us right at the start, fix your eyes on Jesus. And then he moves on in verses 10 to 13 to describe how we should respond to Jesus. You know, we've had this amazing announcement of who Jesus is, but what should we do with that? How should we respond to Jesus? How should we respond to that? And he asks us this question through these next verses. And he asks us the question, are you receiving Jesus? Are you receiving Jesus? And in verses 10 and 11 that we've got up there, John starts off by describing how people rejected Jesus. And you can hear the surprise in John's voice as he writes this. You can kind of feel that tone in there. The surprise as he writes this and as he says it. In verse 10, he describes how Jesus was in the world, how God himself was in the world. The creator of the universe was in this world. but the world didn't recognize him. He walked on this earth. He ate the food that we eat. He drank the drink that we eat. He breathes the air that we breathe, probably with a bit less pollution in those days. But he was on this earth. He was here, this same earth that we're on today. And yet people didn't recognize him. Surely, you can hear John's sort of surprise here. Surely people would recognize him. If God himself came to this earth, surely people would recognize him. They would see that he's the powerful creator of everything around us. But they didn't recognize him. And then in verse 11, John says he came to that which was his own, but his own did not receive him. And what John means by that phrase, his own, is the Israelites. Israel, God's special people. God's chosen people. They're waiting expectantly for the Messiah to arrive at any moment. And here he is, standing right in front of them. Here he is. And they don't recognize him and they don't receive him. And the point that John is trying to get across is that it's more than just not recognizing who he is. It's more than just kind of, oh, I'm not sure I recognize that person. John is trying to get across that this is not just not recognizing someone. This is rejection of God. This is an active rejection of God. This is a stubborn, willful rejection of Jesus. It's like closing your eyes and putting your hands in your ears and going, nah, 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 nah. Rejecting Jesus. Thankfully, my kids haven't learned that one yet. So actually, this is really important for us to take on board, isn't it? There's only two responses to Jesus. Either you recognize him as your God and King, or you fail to recognize him as your God and King and reject him. So either you receive him as your God and King, or you reject him as your God and King. Now, many of you know that I'm a big rugby fan. I love watching rugby. I love watching England play rugby. I used to play rugby when I was a kid. Someone booed then? Outrageous. Oh, Phil, should have known. Tim's behaving himself. And I remember a few years ago that I was still at school in the sixth form, and I was part of the cricket team. And we had a trip to Lord's to see England play cricket against South Africa. And during the lunch break, me and a couple of teammates went off to find some chips for lunch. And we're kind of in this food area getting our chips and stuff. And who should we see but Martin Johnson? Now, I don't know if you know who Martin Johnson is, but he, at that time, was the England rugby captain. And this was before England won the Rugby World Cup. Have Wales ever won the Rugby World Cup, Phil? I'm in so much trouble later. So this was before England won the Rugby World Cup, but it's still, there'd been a big Lions series the year before, which the Lions had won. Martin Johnson was captain of that. So he was a well-known person, even at that stage. And he was massive. He's even bigger than Dan over there. He's huge. He's this massive rugby player. And I remember just being really excited. Martin Johnson, one of my sporting heroes. And I went up to him and said, Martin, can I shake your hand? And he was eating a baked potato at the time with baked beans on. And he had baked beans on his hand. And he goes, it's a big baked bean. He was like, I don't care, let me shake your hand. And his hand was massive. It was like looking kind of up there, this massive hand. I was so excited to meet Martin Johnson and to shake his hand. But the thing that shocked me was in this kind of area, this food area of about maybe 200-300 people, only about four or five of us noticed Martin Johnson. But he's massive, he's huge, he's one of England's greatest ever sports people. But yet hardly anyone noticed him, hardly anyone recognized him. And what John is saying is that Jesus, the Messiah, the Christ, the King, God himself is here. Don't fail to recognize him. Don't reject him. Don't just kind of keep on walking to buy yourself some chips or to get something from the bar. Go up to him, shake his hand, embrace him, receive him, recognize him. Don't reject him. And we see in verses 12 and 13 the great reward for receiving Jesus. Yet to all who did believe him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God, children born not of natural descent, nor of human decision or a husband's will, but born of God. The great reward for receiving Jesus is that we become children of God. We're born again. That's a bit of a weird phrase, isn't it? Born again, becoming children of God. But that's the great, amazing creation work that Jesus does in us. No one can be born again. No one can become a baby again and be born again. It's impossible. But God can do it. God can make us spiritually new creations. And then physically new creations in that last day when we meet him for all eternity. All of us are a new creation. All of us have been born again if we receive Jesus. And that's the great promise. That's the great invitation. No matter what our background is, no matter if we're rich or if we're poor, what race or country we're from, no matter what things we've done in the past, no matter what bad decisions we might have made, if we believe and receive Jesus, then he does that amazing creation miracle in each one of us. So to finish, I want to ask you the question that John is asking through this account of Jesus. Are you receiving Jesus? Are you receiving or rejecting Jesus? There's only those two options, receiving or rejecting Jesus. And if you haven't already, I beg of you to make that decision to receive Jesus. To let him do that new creation work in you and to become a child of God. And maybe you've been a Christian for many years. You've already received Jesus. You're already a new creation. Well, if that's you, then the challenge for you today is to be even more amazed. Be even more amazed of who Jesus is. Be even more amazed that you're a new creation. You are. You're a new creation. However you might feel about yourself, you are a new creation. God has made you. You are. You are a child of God. And you inherit all those amazing promises that God has promised his people throughout the Bible. The amazing promises of an eternity in his perfect kingdom, living with Jesus as your king. No more pain or suffering or anxiety or depression. None of this stuff. A perfect eternity with Jesus in a perfect kingdom. So this Christmas, whatever your plans are, take time to reflect on Jesus. Let his light shine deeply into your heart. Let's pray. Lord, what words can we express to thank you for sending your son Jesus to this earth? Help us to fix our eyes on him and never to wander away from him. Lord, help us to live our lives receiving him daily as we learn more about him and to be continually more and more amazed by him. Amen.